Welcome to the Asia Chessboard, the podcast that examines geopolitical dynamics in Asia and takes an inside look at the making of grand strategy. I'm Andrew Schwartz at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
This week, Mike and Jude are joined by Mr. Tatsuya Terazawa, Chairman and CEO of the Institute of Energy Economics in Japan. Previously, he served at Japan's Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, where he held leading positions including the Vice Minister of International Affairs. They discuss Japan and energy transitions.
Welcome to the Asia Chessboard. I'm Mike Green. I'm joined, as always, with my co-host, Jude Blanchett, and with Mr. Tatsuya Terazawa, who is Chairman and CEO of the Institute of Energy Economics in Japan. Terazawa-san served previously as Senior Advisor to the Cabinet Office of Minister Yasutoshi Nishimura. He served in METI, the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, where he began his career, rose to the heightened position of Vice Minister for International Affairs. He also is Senior Specially Appointed Professor at Tokyo University of Science. He teaches international negotiations. Terazawa-san's held positions in Tokyo, New York, and has been one of the big strategic thinkers for METI on technology policy, on energy, on international trade. So delighted to have you to help us unpack the energy transition, technology decoupling, and Japan's economic security strategy. We always start by asking how you got here. And in Japan, it's a less windy road than with Americans who go in and out of jobs. You joined METI after university, but what put you on this path? And what got you interested in economic, international economic policy?
Well, I'm 62 years old, so it will take a while to complete a whole answer to your question. But try to make it quick. One of the reasons why I became a government official dates back to 1976, when I spent 1 year with my family in the suburb of New York. I was a high school kid, but that was a time when I recognized that as a single individual at a high school, I was sort of representing Japan. I was answering questions about Japan at the time of the high school. And I think that was a trigger point in which I wanted to do something related to the Japanese government. And my father was working for a major trading company. And so naturally, trade and industry became an area close to my attention. And that is the reason why in 1984, when I graduated college, I decided to enter into METI. This is the former organization to the current METI, 1984. Since then, I had worked for METI, or the Japanese government, for 35 years, covering various areas, including trade policy, including the time when, it sounds like a long, long time ago, but the U.S. and Japan were engaged in occasional or frequent trade frictions. And also, I was in charge of economic policies to deal with the burst of the bubble, as well as to deal with the Lehman shock. And I was also the executive assistant to Prime Minister Noda between 2011 and 2012 to deal with the aftermath of the Great East Japan earthquake, including the Fukushima nuclear accident. My final position with METI was the Vice Minister for International Affairs at METI, the position with which I helped the then Prime Minister, the late Shinzo Abe, in his very, very active international top-level diplomacies. And at the time, I helped support the preparation for the G20 summit meeting in Osaka, and I also developed the agenda of economic security, including 5G and critical minerals. So this is the 35 years of my career with the government, and now I'm heading a energy think tank today.
So where were you in 1987? I'm curious, when you had joined METI, maybe you were on your second assignment.
At the time in 1987, I was seconded to the Japan Fair Trade Commission. Fair Trade Commission Japan is like the Department of Justice or the U.S. FTC in charge of anti-monopoly policies. That was the position I had in 1987.
Okay. I asked because I was working in USTR. I was a lowly intern, but I was in charge of auto parts negotiations. And I remember that as a very fierce battle between USTR and METI, but you were not across the table. The ministry and with it, Japan's economic policy have changed so much since you joined, from Gyosei Shiro administrative guidance and METI-led industrial policy to issues you worked on like entrepreneurship, developing private capital, market incentives, and really globalizing Japan's economy. Did you have mentors within the leadership of METI as you took on these roles at the Fair Trade Commission or thinking about entrepreneurship? Or was it kind of a new world as you were looking at a Japanese economic policy sort of after industrial policy, after economic miracle, after administrative guidance? Did it feel like a very new, open world to you? Or was it the playbook that you learned from your senpai in the ministry?
As Mike described, the nature of our policies changed dramatically since the time I entered METI. There was no prepared playbooks at the time. We tried to come up with the right directions or right sets of policies as we faced new challenges. In retrospect, we can go over the history quite easily, but at every moment, we tried to look at the situation and tried to come up with our best sets of policies. Once again, there was no pre-prepared playbooks, but there was no specific guru or mentors leading the process. I think it was a collective effort to come up, struggling to come up with the right policies to address the challenges we were facing.
I've always thought of METI as one of the most strategic ministries in Japan, a ministry that innovates, that looks at geopolitical trends and comes up with options to strengthen Japan's position in economic terms, but in national security terms as well. And one of those big transitions which you played a role in was developing economic security strategies during the Abe years. And that included a lot of decisions about de-risking and decoupling in technology. And when you were the Vice Minister for International Affairs, I remember Japan led in creating a US-Japan-EU trade ministerial to talk about particularly technology competition. You know, METI had a big role in thinking about free flow of data with trust, this idea developed in the G7 and G20. So there were a lot of strategic initiatives that came from Japan to try to align the US and Japan especially, but also Europe, Korea, Canada, Australia around technology competition. Can you tell us a bit about what the assumptions were, what the goal was? How do you think it went?
I think Japan was the first among the leading economies to start talking about economic security. Well, economic security was talked about among the major countries, but it was basically about energy security. I think we expanded economic security to include technology. And the reason I think Japan was the first to highlight technology was that we are very close to China, and we were strongly aware of the very, very rapid rise of China, not just militarily, but also in the technology and also the infrastructure sectors. And so, first of all, we faced a competition. And number two, since we went through the rare earth embargo in 2010, which was imposed by China, we were aware that this is not just about competition technology. As long as we have vulnerabilities, we could be exploited of that vulnerabilities at any time to pursue our political motives. So in order to ensure that we remain competitive in technology and also we not be overly dependent on China, that led to the design of economic security policies. It was very broad. I recall that I think I was the first in introducing a law to strengthen the investment screen by the Japanese government. Throughout our post-war history, the restrictions against investment had always been a history of relaxing. We started with a very protectionist investment regime because our industries were infant. But facing the pressures from the world, including the US, we had to liberalize our investment framework. I think it was in 2017 that as the Director General responsible for investment screening, I introduced the first legislation to strengthen the investment screening. And the reason was that we were aware that Chinese companies were approaching Japanese companies for possible M&As, and that could lead to the leakage of technology, which could undermine our technology leadership and also could have strategic implications. So those are the reasons why we came to highlight economic security with a very broad range of policies. And at the time we started to argue economic security, that was when the US approached us with their concern about 5G. So in addition to economic competition and over-dependence, that strategic or security aspect was added with 5G. So with the 5G issue, we recognize that we need to protect our technology and to make our technology strong enough so that we will not face risks with regard to the security aspect as well. So economic competition, over-dependence, and security concern, those were combined to elevate our economic security issues. And we started to work together with the U.S. government in exploring which would be the specific projects or areas that we needed to work on.
So I'm so glad you went back to 2010 and gave us a short history of the development of that economic security strategy, because I go to so many briefings and so many conferences and read so many articles where authors in Korea or Australia or Japan write about how their countries are stuck in this US-China tech war, as if Washington suddenly woke up and had this idea to have a technology competition policy. And the reality is, in 2010, you and other colleagues from JETRO and METI, and some from Kidanren and industry, were in Washington constantly talking about challenges as China weaponized trade and weaponized economic interdependence. And it was because of the shock in 2010. That's when the Senkaku incident happened, when a Japanese Coast Guard cutter was rammed by a Chinese maritime fisheries militia boat. And the short version of the story is Japan arrested the captain, let him go later, but China fiercely retaliated with export embargoes on critical minerals that Japan needed for its industry, arresting Japanese business people, all WTO violations, by the way. And it just sent a shock to Japan in 2010. And frankly, Washington was not focused on economic security. The 5G thing was different, because that was a signals intelligence experts worried about initially very specific security concerns, and it broadened. So I just want to underline what you just said, because what it demonstrates is how influential Japan was in developing economic security strategies the U.S. and other countries have followed. You may not be happy with the U.S. economic security strategy right now, but a lot of the stimulus over 10 years ago came from Japan. And I think many, many people fail to realize how much American approaches on this are shaped by our allies and by the embargoes and things that Japan faced.
Thank you very much for your kind assessment of Japan's role in economic security. You're right. As I said, Japan was the first to be exposed to the risk associated with economic security. I discussed the 2010 Senkaku incident, but it could go even farther to the past. In 2005, there was a massive anti-Japanese demonstrations that took place in Japan. And we were shocked because many of our factories and retail outlets were attacked by the demonstrators. So this is another aspect of economic security, the total dependence, not just on the supply, but on the market or manufacturing, would also expose you to various risks. So that is exactly the time when Japan started to argue for China plus one. I participated in a conference very recently in the United States discussing about China, and I heard many arguments about, well, we should pursue a China plus one. But that was in this year, 2023. We started to think about that in 2005. And so I think in a sense, because we were so close, we were exposed to those risks. And when I was approached by the U.S. about the risk associated with 5G, it certainly educated me to the security aspect of the technology. But at the time, I recall, as Mike talked about, I stressed to my U.S. counterparts, 5G is important, but it is not just 5G that is important. 5G can be compared in the terms of 20th century analogy as pipelines. Pipelines are important, were important in the 20th century. Pipelines would be important for the 21st century, for the digital world, and that could be 5G. But with that analogy, I mentioned that if we are talking about pipelines, it's not just about 5G. We have to talk about, for example, submarine cables for telecommunication. And in addition to pipelines, we have to think about what goes inside those pipelines. In the 20th century, it was oil. The 21st century, it is data. And that is the reason why we proposed the idea of data-free flow with trust, because while 5G was very important, but at the time, US was only focused on 5G. But we took note of the importance of 5G, but we expanded the areas which we had to pay attention to, including submarine cables and including data. And at the same time, we started to highlight the risk associated with critical minerals, referring to the 2010 Senkaku incident. So I think together with the U.S., we expanded the scope of economic security issues.
I wonder if we can stay on the de-risking issue, but just shift the angle slightly, which is to another issue that you've worked a lot on, which is on energy policy and the energy transition. In the G7 leaders communique in Hiroshima back in May, the language was that the grouping is pushing for de-risking, not decoupling. And then in the next sentence, it said that the group would also drive the transition to clean energy economies of the future. Some have argued that there's a bit of a tension between de-risking from China and the speed of the energy transition because of the large role that China plays in electric vehicles, battery technology, solar panels. So I just wanted to ask an initial question, which is, as you think about the necessity of economic security for all the reasons you just laid out, do you see any trade-offs in terms of the energy transition for Japan or more globally?
I hesitate to use the word trade-off, but I take your point that there is a tension between the need for energy transition and the need to enhance our economic security. And one of the areas is, Judy, you're correct, China dominates currently the supply of critical minerals, which will be essential for clean technologies. China dominates the supply of solar panels, and China is about to dominate the supply of wind power generation, and also they are very strong in batteries and strong in EVs. So if nothing is done, the trend towards energy transition would multiply the strength of the Chinese companies and industries. So that is where I think we need to have a policy response. While China had a very strong policy initiative to push for these clean energy technologies, the West have lacked a comparable sets of policies in the past. And now the US, EU, and Japan are waking up to come up with a policy response to ensure that we will not be overly dependent on China for those inputs as well as technologies. We are still on the way. We have not really succeeded yet, but it is nice to know that countries are finally taking steps. The IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act by the US, is certainly a step in that direction. But with all my due respect to my friends in the US, while it is a positive step forward, the fundamental problem of the IRA is it is trying to solve the problem by basically production within the US only. There are some exceptions for automobiles. Automobiles is North America. But with some of those minor exceptions, mostly the design of IRA is trying to compete with China by manufacturing in the US alone. This may be good for jobs, but in terms of really competing with China, I don't think it would be realistic to be able to compete with China if the production is basically concentrated in the US. It has to be larger for at least two reasons. One is that you need to have lower cost. The reason why Chinese solar panels are so powerful is that they're cheap. Unfortunately, the US is not the lowest cost producing location. So in order to compete and have alternatives, you have to develop locations, regions, where you can produce products or technologies in a cheaper manner, which would have to be working together with like-minded countries. And number two, it's not just the cost. The reason why China can come up with low-cost technology is that they have the scale. The US market is huge. You have a huge population. But in terms of population, US is about one-fourth of China. Maybe American people may spend twice or three times more. But in order to have a competitiveness over a long period of time, you need to have scale. And the scale cannot be achieved by the US market alone. you have to work with other like-minded countries. So I think the IRA is a step in the right direction, but falling short of addressing the problem by limiting its geographical focus.
Yeah, I think you highlighted one of the challenges, which is countries like the United States are starting to wake up and follow Japan's lead, but the policies are driven by a nationalist impulse and also parochial corporate interests. And we have the challenge of a lot of countries within like-minded democratic countries are also competing with each other. And Beijing doesn't have that problem because it has a large army of companies, highly subsidized and all playing for Team China. If I can stay on this thread of tensions for a moment, I wonder now if I can zoom out from the issue of China and just talk about geopolitics more broadly and how they impact, again, the speed and scale and trajectory of the energy transition. I think the invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin and the Russian army threw a lot of energy transition plans out the window, or at least I think forced a lot of countries to rethink them. I'm curious, as you look over geopolitical trends of the last few years, starting with the invasion of Ukraine, of course, we have U.S.-China tensions, we have U.S. politics, and we're now starting to see, as we were talking about before we clicked record, some of the clear results of climate change showing up in Tokyo and Europe and the United States. I'm curious for your thoughts on what the functional effect of geopolitics has been, thinking on the energy transition, and if we assume that this new geopolitical volatility is likely here to stay, that's going to force governments to be balancing what they want to do in the long term with responding to challenges of the present, which may mean that you have to shelve or at least delay some of the more aggressive energy transition or climate mitigation steps. So how do you think about navigating this terrain?
Well, I think that is exactly what we are missing. The people dealing with the climate change issues and the people engaged in geopolitics, these two groups of people do not necessarily talk with each other, especially within the government. That is where there has to be integration or alignment of our climate change policies and geopolitical concerns. One example is that the people caring so much about the global climate change would push for renewable energies, that's fine, and they would argue that the acceleration of the shift to renewable energies would resolve their geopolitical concerns right away. And I can recall watching a BBC news program in which the energy minister of the UK government was making an announcement at the Underground Banker, which was used by Winston Churchill during World War II, to come up with his new energy security strategy and claiming that from now on, UK will not have to depend upon authoritarian leaders. But he was talking about the shift for renewable energies and nuclear, but he was not talking about the dependence, the growing dependence on critical minerals or solar panels or batteries or EVs on another emerging country. So when we talk about geopolitics, it's not just about Russia. Certainly, reducing dependence on fossil fuel would reduce our dependence on Russia, but the energy transition toward the clean energy technologies would lead to another possible rise of another challenger. So this is something that certainly we have to think about. And in our energy transition towards cleaner technology, we have to make sure that we manage our dependence on China in a rational manner. This would require diversification of the sources. This would require being more efficient. This would require recycling and maybe stockpiling. But also, I believe that we would have to start thinking about how can we reduce our CO2 emission at the same time rationalize the use of critical minerals, for example, or batteries. One example is that when we have renewable energies deployment, the power goes up and down. That's intermittency. To deal with intermittency, one solution would be having as many batteries as possible. But this would result in a massive demand for critical minerals, which would only help countries strong in critical minerals. So this is where we need to think more about energy security, climate change, and geopolitics. This would also go for passenger vehicles. Our European friends have a tremendous love for battery EVs. That's okay. But in order to have long distance driving, one of the approach is to have as many batteries as possible on vehicles, just like Tesla is doing. That would be okay for very rich people. And as long as the number of vehicles is very limited, it will not affect global supply and demand of critical minerals. But just assuming, if we are talking about the global solution, can we have all the countries globally, all the people owning a Tesla-like cars with as many batteries as possible? That would not be affordable, and that will lead to a massive increase in critical minerals. This is where we have to find out the best balance, not just with the minimizing CO2 emission reduction, but also the rationalization of the use of critical minerals. The third example is that while ultimately the expansion of renewable energies would reduce our dependence on fossil fuel over the long term, but the transition is very long, and we will have to continue using fossil fuels in a significant manner for decades during that long transition period. And who will be using fossil fuels much more than others? It will be the global south. So one of the problems is that if we just tell the world that stop investing and financing for fossil fuel projects, what could happen in the long transition that with underinvestment, there could be a shortage of supply, which can result in occasional price hikes or energy crisis due to that shortage. And this would hurt the global south as well as us. So this is, once again, that we need to have a balance. This is about the balance between climate change policies and energy policies. So what I'm trying to get at is that the global climate issues, geopolitics, and energy policies, these three policies may have significant tension among themselves, but there is no real coordination among those three policies. And this is absolutely absent in many countries. And Japan is not an exception, but fortunately, because of METI, as Mike said, METI has those three elements within one roof. So relatively speaking, we are better in the coordination of these three aspects than others, but this is a global initiative. We need to have a coordination of these three policy areas in the US, in Australia, in Europe.
Yeah, this is just another indication of where the United States can be learning from Japan, because there's still an incredible amount of siloing in the United States between relevant stakeholders in these areas. And certainly the national security folks and the climate folks and the energy folks are not often sitting down in the same room trying to harmonize or at least coordinate approaches, or as you say, just try to navigate some of the tensions that exist. If I can stay with tension for one final question here, and then I'll kick it back over to Mike. China is Japan's largest trading partner. Bilateral trade last year was in the order of $330 billion USD, give or take. We're witnessing another spate of Beijing's anger and disinformation, this time over the treated nuclear wastewater coming from Fukushima. It's one of these odd things to watch from a distance, because every now and again, there's a little bit of an early sign that potentially Beijing is going to try to repair the relationship with Tokyo. And then for whatever reason, nationalist impulses, sensitivity, dysfunction in Beijing elite politics takes over. And as we've seen, there's just been this massive disinformation campaign by Chinese state media over the Fukushima water leak. But more importantly, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense for Beijing to be picking a fight right now when it is dealing with fights amongst a lot of its major peripheral neighbors. How do you see Tokyo able to handle this relationship? There's, as you say, economic security and de-risking conversations going on. But on the other hand, China remains very, very important economic partner of Tokyo's. We also have concerns about PLA behavior around the Senkaku Islands, which is again flaring up. Conversations over Taiwan are flaring up. How can or should Tokyo handle this balance between an economic relationship with China while at the same time we're seeing Xi Jinping's foreign policy become more erratic and aggressive?
Well, that is a very tough challenge. that we are facing. If I can just briefly talk about Fukushima's release of treated wastewater, this is exactly as it described on Chinese government's disinformation propaganda to discredit Japan in this region. And I think it would be wrong to see this as simply China versus Japan. I think China is challenging the existing world order globally, especially in Asia. And whatever they can do to enhance their influence and discredit the U.S. or Japan, I think they believe that serves their strategic interest. And I think that is the reason why they have chosen the release of treated water from Fukushima as a propaganda, which they believe can help discredit Japan. But this is something that I would like to stress, is that the use of water is very important. It is treated wastewater. It's not the contaminated water, as Chinese claim. It has been treated to reduce the radioactivity elements just to tritium, which exists in the natural world, and limit the level of tritium to an acceptable level, much lower than the level of tritium released in the water, released by the Chinese operating nuclear reactors in place. And so we have to see this, not just in the China-Japan context, but China vis-a-vis the existing world order, which would include the U.S. and Japan in this region. So it's a huge strategic competition taking place. Having said so, as Jude pointed out, China is our largest trade partner, and our industries cannot think of their business without their trade with China. So we have to continue reasonable and stable trade relationship with China. That is the reality. So how can you balance these two? That is extremely difficult. But I think that we should not be seeking good relationship for the good relationship sake of purpose. When we are facing disinformation propaganda, we need to fight back. And at the same time, we need to address the potential vulnerabilities in our supply chain, including critical minerals, but also others. And when there is any kind of economic coercion by China, hopefully we can work together with other countries, including Australia. China tends to engage in economic coercion when they see the necessity. And I understand Australia was a target recently by Chinese economic coercion. I think just as we are having alliance militarily, I think we need to have alliance against economic coercion. So by having sort of alliance among like-minded countries, if any country is hit by economic coercion by China, other countries cooperate to help that country. For example, if China hits Australia with wine, the US and Japan should be drinking more Australian wine, for example. And if there is a disinformation campaign conducted by China, I think it is important for other countries to support the countries which are being targeted. Because, for example, many countries in the Pacific Ocean, the smaller island countries, may not have the scientific background to tell which argument is true. And even if Japan makes the argument that the treated water is safe, they would have no basis to make their judgment. It would be very helpful if other countries like the US and Australia would provide an objective scientific assessment of the treated water. So this kind of alliance building, reducing our dependence vis-a-vis China, and also having this framework to protect ourselves against economic coercion or disinformation campaign will be essential. With that background, with this as a basis, we would try to realize better relationship with China, and having communication channels with China would be helpful. And we do not consider that we are entering into two completely different systems. People would like to think about that, especially the media people, but that two different systems exist in a relatively small, very sensitive areas. The vast majority of our trading and business relationship with China is a single integrated market. So we should not look at the overall big picture. The vast majority of our business relation, trade relationship with China is integrated. At the same time, we have a relatively small sector in which I would have to say we have two different economic systems. And I think it is important to be very strategic and careful in designing that small sector, which will be two different systems. There's an expression that we should have a high fence, a small field, in our relationship with China to protect the sensitive technologies. We have to be careful in designing how large we want to make that field with high fences. We have to be very selective and careful in making it not too broad. But if we set up those fields, we have to make the fences very high. And that is where we need to have cooperation of all the like-minded countries, not just among the US, Australia, and Japan. We need other partners with technology to join. In that regard, we need to have the cooperation by our Korean friends with technology and our European friends with technology to ensure that we have a very strong high fence to protect our technologies against China for those small fields.
Let me ask you quickly before we end about one area where Japan and Australia seem to have some friction. You know, in our surveys at the US Study Center, 3/4 of Australians want a security treaty with Japan, and Japan is the most trusted country in the world. A few years ago, Lowy Institute found that Abe Shinzo was the most trusted leader in the world for Australians. But there is this one contentious area. You sort of indirectly referenced it when you said it's hard for the US and Australia to coordinate the energy transition, the need for LNG to reduce emissions. And the Australian government has put out emission reduction policies that cause uncertainty for Japan as an LNG customer. And you've been quoted about it. What can you say to help us understand this Japan-Australia, what looks like a disagreement over LNG and climate policies?
The fact shows that Australia has been our largest LNG supplier for decades. And for us, Australia is, as of now, our most trusted LNG supplier. And we sincerely hope that since LNG would continue to play a significant role in the long energy transition, we certainly hope that Australia would continue playing that role as our most trusted supplier of LNG. And my wish is strong in that regard. At the same time, the recent safeguard mechanism to reduce CO2 emission is posing a challenge for many Japanese companies conducting the import of LNG from Australia. While we respect Australia's wishes to reduce CO2 emission, I strongly hope that those initiatives to reduce CO2 emissions will be consistent with the legitimate business interests of Japanese operators. One example is that there is one major project in which is already underway. The final investment decision has been made several years ago, and they expect to start supplying LNG in a few years. But suddenly, with a change in this policy, it is now required that the new LNG projects would have to be net zero starting on day one. If this is about a brand new project, you can build in the measures to realize net zero at the time of day one. But when you have already started the construction and you only have 2 years left, to realize that neutrality in that limited time is extremely difficult. So I think we can find solutions to respect the aspiration of the Australian government and people to reduce CO2 emission while respecting the legitimate business interest of Japanese LNG players, which have been dependent on the supply from Australia. And there could be various means to accommodate these two interests from the Australian side and Japanese side. I think we should start discussing what could be a practical, pragmatic solutions to deal with these two potentially conflicting interests from both sides. And I believe that is possible.
I'm glad you clarified that. And this LNG issue between Japan and Australia is the one area of real dissonance in an otherwise really important alignment of two powerful maritime democracies and economies in the Indo-Pacific. So I hope it does get worked out. This is a moment in diplomacy where both sides should probably step back, talk about strategic objectives, first principles, and restart the dialogue, because it sure looks to me like there's an impasse, which is not good for either country or anyone else who wants to see more alignment on the energy transition and on economic security issues. Terezo-san, thanks so much for joining us. Your career really is, in a nutshell, the history of Japan's transition to being a thought leader on economic security and the energy transition. Pearls of wisdom, and I'm really glad you could join me and Jude. And I think a lot of people will get out of this a lot of really thoughtful insights into how the U.S. and Australia and other countries should think about economic security. So great having you.
For more on strategy and the Asia program's work, visit the CSIS website at csis.org and click on the Asia program page. And for more on the U.S. Studies Center in Sydney, please visit ussc.edu.au.